Welcome to Exotic Pets. I'm Tracy Hotchner, whom you may know as the dog and cat lady, but I'm wearing a different hat here. With the brilliant collaboration of my co-host, Dr. Doug Mader, the world-renowned veterinarian specializing in exotic animals, we are here to celebrate all the other pets that share people's lives. This show is for people interested in pets that slither, hop, creep, fly, or swim, from bunnies to iguanas, parrots to ferrets, snakes to tortoises. Dr. Doug is going to teach us the physical requirements of these exotic pets and how to manage the often challenging environments and correct diets essential to their welfare. Dr. Doug Mader is the author of the wonderful memoir, The Vet at Noah's Ark, Stories of Survival from an Inner City Animal Hospital. He is recognized worldwide as a veterinary specialist on exotics and is the author of four major veterinary textbooks on reptiles and amphibians. We are proud to have ZooMed Laboratories as the founding sponsor of Exotic Pets. ZooMed has earned its reputation as the number one reptile and amphibian supplier in the world from simple beginnings 45 years ago as a passion project for one man who still runs it. Renowned as the international leader in UVB and heat lighting, ZooMed manufactures all their reptile supplies, accessories, and tools in the U.S., which they test on their own collection of animals, which surround everyone at headquarters. We're also sponsored by Oxbow Animal Health, the one brand that has stood out for more than 30 years as the leader in health and wellness for small mammals. Veterinarians, rescues, and passionate pet parents worldwide trust Oxbow to support the health and happiness of their small pets. Oxbow provides for rabbits and guinea pigs, ferrets and chinchillas, hamsters and gerbils, mice and rats, because these small pets have big hearts and require special nutrition and care. Oxbow has everything needed for their best life, the right hay and nutritionally complete foods, treats and supplements, litter and bedding, and a whole line of enrichment products created so your little loved ones can chew, play, hide, and explore every day. We're also brought to you by the bird food specialist Zoopreme, which started with a revolutionary yet simple idea: provide exceptional diets for extraordinary animals. Best known as the bird nutrition specialist, Zoopreme creates many foods for birds of all sizes, and they also make a variety of treats to appeal to every sort of bird and enhance their lives. I am pretty excited to have a star of the herpetology world to join us. He has, I don't know, do you count these things in millions, Dion? I don't know, YouTube, Instagram. He is the guy who adores everything that slithers and wriggles, and his site is called Reptiliatus. I hope I did that correctly. And he really does have millions of people who follow all of his advice and information, and especially his enthusiasm for the herps. Dion, when did you get bitten by the bug of frogs and reptiles and all these creepy, crawly, slithery things? Were you like 5 years old, or did it happen when you were an adult? When did this happen?
Well, firstly, I just want to say thank you so much for having me. I'm excited. This is wonderful. It's a pleasure. To answer your question, frankly speaking, I think I've always had an immense love and appreciation for these animals. As long or as early as I can think, even like a tiny small child, maybe a toddler, I think perhaps it started, as it does for many of us, with a love for dinosaurs. And
oh,
I was always that child who, yes, I was always the kid who played with my, growing up in the early 90s, the Jurassic Park toys,
yes,
instead of G.I. Joes and things like that. So
right.
I think part of it is that. And then from my earliest memories, I remember just if I'd ever go visit a farm or anywhere with a little pond, my mother especially fostered that love and would show me the tadpoles, and I'd always want to go look at frogs and turtles and newts and salamanders. And I think it just kind of snowballed from there, you know, the curiosity and interest. I'm very lucky that my parents saw that love and created a space for it to grow and develop, for the interest to be there. And and for me to pursue it, you know?
That's really well said. To encourage that when you see that in somebody young. It's funny, I remember having that same fascination, but it was kind of private. I didn't feel there was a space in which to kind of enlarge that, but I had piano lessons, Mrs. Z, a very nice Chinese lady in Connecticut. And I didn't really care for the piano lessons, but I loved the part when my sister had her lesson and there was a little stream out back. And I was exactly like that. The best part was by the stream, looking at all the things that were living there, especially in the puddly parts where the stream wasn't moving quickly and you could really watch them and the water kind of magnified them. And you're reminding me of that. And tadpoles into frogs was the really cool part. And that's something that on your YouTube channel, Instagram, one of the things you do focus on is raising tadpoles to froglets. Now, tell me how this is something that you can encourage other people to do. How do they get tadpoles? I'm ignorant of how you do it unless there's a stream out behind your piano teacher.
Well, I mean, I do work with quite a variety of animals, and I would say a lot of the animals I'm keeping currently, so I have many frog species that I keep. Not all of them are reproducing in my care. There's a few species that are a lot more tricky to get that right, and I haven't necessarily taken the steps to even try. But at present, I breed a few species of poison dart frog.
Wow.
And they're, just for the record, completely harmless in captivity.
Oh, thank you.
But no worries. But yeah, I mean, that's been quite interesting. Without getting too deep into it, like, there are a few species that come from a genus called Ufaga, which are obligate egg eaters. So it's not very hard for the hobbyist or pet keeper to reproduce those, so long as they have a healthy pair that are thriving in captivity, as they're obligate egg eaters, as I mentioned. So it's the female that actually has to raise the tadpole by depositing infertile eggs in the bromeliad that they're raising their tadpole in. So you don't do anything. You kind of just sit back and observe from a safe distance so that, you know, you're not stressing them out. And the next thing you know, your tadpole's crawling out as a little frog.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Explain this about it being an obligate egg eater. And let me just say, I think that the reason that I reach out to you is that you are so scientific and you say, you know, I don't want to get too specific, but that's what's great about what you do, Dion. You understand the history of the animal, and you also study, as you said, well, I haven't fully studied how to reproduce some of the more exotic ones, if you will. But I think it's really important that people understand that hobbyists like yourself or an educator like yourself, you take it seriously in the best sense of the word. It's not some throwaway. It's something you really are being a caretaker of and showing respect for, even in the idea of don't get too close to the terrarium. They need a little bit of privacy. So when what do you mean by obligate egg eater?
Well, yeah, and thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I mean, I'll just quickly say that, you know, I do take it very seriously, especially as, I mean, it's not something I anticipated per se in the beginning, but when you amass a sizable following, there's, I always like to use that Spider-Man reference, that with a great power comes great responsibility.
Yes.
So whether it was something I desired or not, which frankly, as humbly as possible, it wasn't something I was expecting to happen. I do see the immense responsibility in ensuring that I am mindful and constantly seeking to improve and offer the best care information possible, because as much as we have to independently seek truth and, you know, discern information, we also have a responsibility, especially with animal care, in ensuring that what we share is true and has the best in mind for those animals.
Yes.
Because if we share misinformation, it can affect a whole lot of other pets, not just our own.
That's
but
right.
Just wanted to add that. But
it's well added,
question,
and
yes,
also
so,
attitude yeah. matters. If people are going to follow you for the excitement and fun of watching what you do, all good. If they're going to follow you and they want to follow in your footsteps, even in a minor way, they need to do it with the same attitude you have, that that this isn't something you do on a whim, whether you're a child or an adult or an adult with a child. You do it with the understanding that now you have a responsibility and now you have a commitment. It's not something, I mean, the idea of so many of these creatures, certainly in the decades even before you were even born and being a toddler, there was this flushability. You flushed a goldfish you got at the fun fair. You flushed a baby alligator. Oops. You flushed a frog. You flushed anything that was no longer convenient. That's no longer acceptable. And I think that you hold a very high standard, and it's why having you on this show as an expert, you are an expert. You're a self-created expert and a very legitimate one. And I think it's important that people follow somebody, not just for the fun and the excitement, but because it's the real deal. So, all right, enough about that, but it's really true. And I want to make that very clear. I didn't, it's not
thank you so much.
Oh, wow, you have all these followers because, I don't know, you tap dance or twerk or something during your Instagram. I don't know. I don't follow anybody. I'm not a TikTok follower, but it's really great that someone is using those platforms for good. And for knowledge and for inspiration. And I really admire that. So back to obligate egg eaters. What does that mean?
Yes. Yeah. So essentially, ufaga translates from Latin to obligate egg eater. And it means that they're essentially obligated or they can only be raised by eating the infertile eggs of their mother.
Wow.
So my understanding, and I have a few friends that are, I guess, more deeply invested in working with this genus, but I've grown to really love them through, being close to those friends and starting to work with them more myself. My understanding is they've even tried, not the friends, but scientists have tried to raise the froglets, the tadpoles rather, with the eggs of other species of poison dart frog in hopes that something more prolific that produced more eggs would. They could use those eggs, and it doesn't work. It has to be either the same species or very closely related in the same family. So it's so interesting from an evolutionary perspective how these animals have evolved. And it's an interesting strategy, right? It means
yes.
that the mother is very involved in raising up that frog. And with a lot of these animals, we see more so the habit or the practice of depositing eggs somewhere and leaving and good luck,
Right.
Even so far that when they hatch, they might even see them as a food source. But when you have these tiny little frogs that are invested in returning to these, we call them bromeliad axils, the little different nooks in each between the folds of the bromeliad plant. It's an epiphytic, we see them at like garden nurseries and such. They like to use bromeliads because they pool or collect water.
Interesting.
So they'll often, wherever they're from, whether it's Colombia or Costa Rica or different countries in Central and South America that these frogs come from, they'll often use those plants to raise their tadpoles. So they'll deposit the egg somewhere, and as soon as they develop, they'll actually bring the tadpole on their back to the bromeliad, like
no.
a little piggyback ride.
No.
And they slide into the pool, and then that's where they come back every day or every few days, and the female lays the infertile eggs. They slide in there, and the tadpole's eating them until it grows up into a little frog. And then
wow.
at that point, it's on its own. But it's pretty neat. And yeah, it won't eat anything else, because a lot of other frogs, they'll feed on algae and different little organisms, mosquito larvae, whatever is in the silt and bottom of a pond, but that doesn't work for these. Like a lot of us will that are raising different types of frogs in captivity will use maybe different kinds of fish food and things like that to raise their tadpoles, but this will not work for the obligate egg eaters. They only can be raised by their mother. So if she chooses not to do something right, if she doesn't get the hang of it from the beginning, which can be frustrating or discouraging. Sometimes you have a pair and they're laying these eggs and they develop into tadpoles, but the female doesn't do anything with them. Unfortunately, you just have to wait till she gets it right because you can't do anything to really help.
So if a mother,
but they're interesting.
So if she doesn't get it right, if she misses the boat, so to speak, is that in your experience and knowledge, is that something that is missing in her, I'm going to say, genetically? Is she not wired correctly to keep her species going?
You know, I can't speak too strongly to that. I can share that a few friends of mine are personally dealing with frogs that are sort of taking a while to get the hang of it in that sense. And I would attribute it more so to a young female that just lacks the experience. But I think it's kind of evolutionarily hardwired into them to get it right eventually. But they found that, you know, they might sometimes lay eggs a few times and leave them, and then all of a sudden one day they're doing it right, and it might just take time. That's sort of all it is. I mean, there could be exceptions where there's an animal just never gets it right, and through the laws of evolution, it doesn't pass on those genes, right? Because it's not going to breed.
But maybe the ones who don't get it right shouldn't be passing them on, because otherwise we as a little frog species can't survive. Or on the other hand, maybe it's normal for a few times to not get it right, or there'd be too many.
Yeah.
Maybe that's evolutionarily how you limit the number of those that grow up and, you know, vie for the resources. Or maybe it's because if they live in captivity, they have a smaller space, and something in their very brilliant genetic hardwiring says, it's going to get too crowded here. Let's just hold off on this litter. It's not really a litter. What do you call it when they lay a lot of eggs? Is it a nest, or what's the word for it?
I suppose I would call it a clutch or of eggs or something
a cluster,
like that.
Yeah, that's a good word.
ER clutch, I think. But
a clutch.
No, and to your last point, that's excellent. I think we have to also remember that in a captive setting, we don't necessarily know and this is why there always needs to be this attitude of wanting to raise the standard and improve the quality of care. Something might work, but there might be a better way to do it. And so it could also be attributed to maybe there aren't enough spots for her that she likes, or she sees something we don't. Like, oh, you know, maybe the humidity is too low. Maybe the enclosure needs to be misted more. So maybe biologically she's laying the eggs and the male's fertilizing them, but she's saying, no, this terrarium isn't conducive to raising a tadpole. We don't know for sure, but it's exciting because a lot of my friends that were having a few issues with it are having a lot of success now. So I think the main cause for that is maybe just the young female not having experience initially, just as many of us struggle with new experiences.
That's right.
And then getting the hang of something, or, you know, a new job, et cetera.
That's right. But
there are certainly other factors to consider and be open-minded to trying to dial in correctly. So
I think one of the things I find most exciting and also touching about experts and would-be experts and wannabe participants in herpetoculture is there's a community, and they really do all help each other. And I've often heard the various vets on the show say, you know, if you want to learn more about reptiles or any kind of amphibian, which is the best one for you, and should it be a beardy, and should it be a gecko, and what kind of a frog, and if a frog is the right thing for you. And there's these reptile shows, and apparently everyone who goes there wants to pass on information and welcome others into the fold, and it isn't just there to sell stuff. It's to inspire other people to do it and do it well. Do you go to any of these reptile shows, or are you so, if you will, famous, that it would be awkward and a little overwhelming for you?
No, and I have to be humble. You know, I'm blessed that there are people that, you know, it's very touching. It really grounds me, or makes me realize that what I'm doing is touching hearts or inspiring others. When I do run into people that share that they like my content, and I really am thankful for that. But it's not I'm not some actor walking around in that space. But I absolutely make the effort to attend reptile shows. We're very lucky that I would say one of the largest events in Canada, which is the Toronto Reptile Expo run by Grant Crossman for many, many years. It's an expo that happens almost on a monthly basis.
And often?
I do try to attend.
Wow.
Almost so, yeah. But that's been a sign of the community growing, you know.
Yes.
I think I attended my first Reptile Expo when I was maybe 14 years old or so, maybe 15, back in, when Dinosaurs Walk by the Window now. I think it would have been 2006 or 7. And, you know, where this has come, even in my lifetime so far, in that short amount of time, the way the community has grown is just so inspiring.
Yes.
And to see this young generation. So actually, just 2 weekends ago, I was at the last expo. It was, I think, March 3rd. So, and so many young children that are so knowledgeable. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, I didn't know this till I was this old.
Right.
And it's really exciting to see. And I agree with you. So, the sense of community, it's one of the only spaces that I think fosters or offers that beyond connecting online or building the friendships from those spaces and making the effort to meet and, you know, to hang out, if you will.
Yes.
But those expos create a space where people can come together and share knowledge, as you said. And I do recommend oftentimes that if someone is serious and doing research about keeping a certain animal, that is a great place for them to pursue finding that animal and, you know, bringing them home, because they can often have a very deep conversation with a breeder that is very well versed in their care and can impart lots of knowledge on that process. And you can build a connection there that, you know, most people, myself included, if you purchase an animal from me, I don't breed as a business or anything like that, but if you are to purchase an animal from me that I've produced in my care, I don't just say, all right, good luck, take care,
right,
like off, throw you to the wind. I'm there for you constantly because I care so much about that animal and I want you to be successful. And I can say that I think all breeders are the same, and they want their animals to, you know, do great, and they want the people that brought them in and adopted them to have the utmost success. So it's a great space for that. And again, so it's an imparting of knowledge, it's encouraging the captive breeding and multiple generations of captive breeding, because there's obviously these stigmas or ideas that, oh, these animals are, you know, they're wild and
right,
whatever, and
right,
of course they're not the same as dogs and cats, but many reptiles have been, you know, reproduced in captivity for so many generations, and they're truly, I don't know if I'd use the word domesticated in the sense, you know, they're not like, they operate differently than a dog or cat per se, but there is some interesting ideas behind their ability to show some level of interest, or I don't know if affection is a word, but at the very least, they're domesticated on a level that they really have learned to sort of depend on human care. If you look at a bearded dragon and a few other species, like the way they are, especially if you raise them from a hatchling, they're very comfortable and they do make fascinating pets. It's just the commitment and understanding that a lot of reptiles live a very long time. But anyhow, I'm digressing a bit.
No,
there,
you're not. You're not digressing.
It's a great space.
And I definitely want to have you back and have another conversation about that human-animal bond and the fact that many of these animals learn to recognize humans and interact with them. I mean, Dr. Doug Mader has talked about many times many of these creatures who come when called, mm-hmm, know their name, recognize they're human versus other humans. And
mm-hmm,
that's part of the excitement and the thrill that you can have that bond,
mm-hmm,
and bridge that gap between,
absolutely,
the species. So, Dion, you're amazing. Reptiliatus is incredible. Anyone who can get to the Toronto Reptile Expo, now you know where to find the guy. But there are reptile expos all across the U.S. as well. And the beautiful thing about the Google machine is it will tell you when and where. Dion, I hope you'll come back. It's really been wonderful to meet you, and inspiring to meet someone who inspires others. So thanks for all the great work you do and continue to do, and to your extended group of fellow enthusiasts. You are all great ambassadors for humans. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much, Tracy. It's been a true pleasure, and absolutely, I'd love to come back and join you on another day.
Dr. Doug Mader and I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Exotic Pets and our desire to educate and inspire you to give your exotics their best possible life. This show is brought to you by the wonderful companies that cater to the needs of exotic pets. From Zubad Laboratories, where they make everything you need to keep your reptiles and amphibians in tip-top shape, to Oxbow Animal Health, with health and wellness solutions for small mammals, and Zupreme, the company dedicated to your bird's nutrition. And if you haven't read Dr. Doug's book, The Vet at Noah's Ark, yet, do yourself a favor and pick up a copy.